From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Friday brings the celebration of the Hindu New Year, as well as the start of the week-long Hindu observance of Ramayana. Now, to the intersection of religion, government, and politics. It's not just the nuns that are getting on the bus for social justice anymore. A powerful new initiative aims to bring the message of North Carolina's Moral Mondays movement to the rest of the nation. This weekend, Sister Simone Campbell, the Reverend William Barber, the Reverend Jim Forbes, and the Reverend Tracy Blackman kick off a 15-state moral revolution tour. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump continued to dominate public attention with comments indicating he'd support criminal penalties for women accessing abortion services. This after a particularly ugly battle between Trump and Senator Ted Cruz over the candidates' respective wives. And the most talked about story that went remarkably, but thankfully, unreported in the mainstream press about alleged infidelities by the senator from Texas. An interesting new survey from the Barna Group this week revealed that despite all the attention directed toward evangelical voters this cycle, this group is actually the least likely to pay attention to this election. The Republican governor of Georgia and the Democratic governor of Virginia both vetoed so-called religious freedom restoration laws in their respective states. It's good to see leaders recognize that this kind of legislation goes way too far in demonizing certain citizens and in dividing communities over matters of simple fairness. But as we saw in North Carolina, it doesn't always work out that way. So eternal vigilance is essential in every town and in every state across the nation. In South Carolina, meanwhile, lawmakers are considering a bill that would hold religious congregations legally responsible for any crimes committed by refugees they sponsor. Later in the show, we'll hear a guest commentary on that story from Interfaith Alliance President Jack Moline. Now, here's what else is coming up on State of Belief Radio.
We have to start by building a wall, a big, beautiful, powerful wall. It can have a gate. It can have a door.
Whether it's Donald Trump railing about a beautiful wall on the border or divisive debates about Syrian refugees and immigration policy in general, too many of our leaders seem to see immigrants primarily as political pawns, useful for heated rhetoric and scaremongering. The rest of us, however, live in a nation both enriched and challenged by its diversity. The Public Religion Research Institute has just released a new report titled How Americans View Immigrants and What They Want from Immigration Reform. And we'll get details from PRRI President Dr. Robert P. Jones.
Some 45 million people, that's one-fifth of the U.S. adult population, now say they belong to no church in particular. 6% of them are either atheist or agnostic.
While surveys offer an invaluable snapshot of a given situation, there's also a need for more in-depth and long-term analysis of headline-making findings. This week, we'll take a scholarly and holistic look at the growing number of religiously unaffiliated Americans with Professor Phil Zuckerman, co-author of The Non-Religious, Understanding Secular People and Societies. But first,
we have not taken away any rights that currently existed in any city in North Carolina. There's a very well-coordinated campaign, national campaign, which is distorting the truth.
The ACLU and equality groups filed a federal lawsuit challenging a controversial law that some are calling the worst anti-LGBT legislation in the country.
It was an almost unprecedented legislative achievement. Nullify local law, alienate a vast majority of the business community, and trample the civil rights of a group of your citizens, all within the head-spinning time span of 12 hours. But that's just what North Carolina's extremist state government managed to do in a special session earlier this month. With an embarrassing focus on access to public toilets, the bill also nullified the very existence of transgender North Carolinians. But it went much farther, restricting the right of municipalities to protect LGBT citizens, and, for good measure, denying North Carolina cities the right to raise the minimum wage. Now, that's a session. While major corporations and cities across the nation responded quickly with moves to boycott the Tar Heel State, boosters of the bill are pointing to several hundred businesses that have expressed their support. Now, a glance at the list reveals outfits such as Heaven's Best Carpet Cleaning, Prayerful Touch Massage, and something actually called God's Glamorous Girls, weighing in favor of this unprecedented power grab. So, there's that. The opposition has lost no time in filing suit, led by the American Civil Liberties Union, along with Lambda Legal and Equality North Carolina. And joining me right now is Elizabeth Gill, Senior Staff Attorney with the ACLU of Northern California. Elizabeth, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
This bill seemed to come out of nowhere. How was the ACLU ready to spring into action so quickly?
The procedure by which this bill was passed was truly extraordinary. You know, within 12 hours, both houses of the legislature had heard the bill and the governor had signed it. Very unusual that any bill gets passed in that kind of time frame, especially given that the legislature actually called a special session just to hear this bill. You know, they weren't sharing the bill language with many folks in the public, and there was a very limited time for debate. Only 5 witnesses were allowed on each side. So we knew that something was potentially coming because we knew that the legislature had called a special session, but we didn't see the language of the bill until last Wednesday.
North Carolina HB 2 has been called unprecedented. Would you explain why we're calling it that?
We've been saying that it's both dangerous and unprecedented. Mm-hmm. It's unconstitutional, which is what we're arguing in our lawsuit. It eliminates protections at a local level for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, LGBT people. But even more than that, so it eliminates local protections from discrimination and locks in that discrimination is allowed here in North Carolina at a statewide level. Mm-hmm. And more than that, it goes further than that, and particularly with respect to transgender people, it requires people in the state of North Carolina to discriminate against transgender people.
Please describe the lawsuit that you filed and why you think it will be successful.
The lawsuit is really just one aspect of what's happening on the ground in North Carolina. And I think you mentioned at the outset of this show that there's been a real show of support for the LGBT community in North Carolina in opposition to the law that is coming at the North Carolina legislature from all directions. So businesses, major national businesses, have stated publicly that they oppose HB 2, that they don't think that the North Carolina legislature is doing the right thing here. Folks on the ground are vigorously protesting the legislature and the governor, a range of civil rights groups and religious figures as well. I think there's a lot of grassroots activity happening to really urge the governor to repeal the law. And in fact, the governor came out with a video message yesterday where he said that he might consider that. So I think, you know, there is a lot of pressure in North Carolina right now, and that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
The lawsuit, we're representing clients, transgender clients in North Carolina who are suffering harm right now because they can't use the facilities that accord with their gender identity. And we're also representing an individual and groups that include lesbian, gay, and bisexual people, you know, who now have been put in a situation where they are less protected under the law in the state of North Carolina than they were previously.
I see. So you have experience here. Are there other jurisdictions in which the ACLU has been successful in pushing back against these kinds of laws?
Yes, you know, actually we've had a lot of success. The governor of South Dakota vetoed this year a law that also targeted transgender people. The governor of Georgia just this week vetoed a law that would have, in the guise of protecting religion, would have allowed for broad-based discrimination against LGBT people. And he vetoed that, I think, in part because of the reaction to North Carolina's HB 2. And a bill is up in Mississippi right now that would be also be very harmful to transgender people. And I think we're seeing a wave in the state legislatures this year of this legislation that's just incredibly, I mean, it's discriminatory, but it's also just mean-spirited. It's sort of in vitriolic language. It sort of condemns transgender people as predators. And it has really no relationship to the reality of who transgender people are. And then much of the legislation also sweeps in lesbian, gay, and bisexual people for discrimination as well. But I think, you know, we have been successful in pushing back on some of these state legislatures and in particular governors. And so one of the effects of the North Carolina legislator rushing through this bill, HB 2, in such an unusual way, denied the ability to kind of put pressure on the governor to veto it. So hopefully he will now be feeling some pressure to repeal it.
With whom are you partnering on the ground in North Carolina in opposing this discriminatory law?
Well, thank you for asking that, because I think there are so many wonderful people who are working on the ground in North Carolina. So Equality North Carolina is a plaintiff in our lawsuit as an organization that works on behalf of LGBT people around the state of North Carolina, as is the ACLU of North Carolina. And then there are also other groups that are doing wonderful work in the state. The Campaign for Southern Equality is there and doing work to push back against this law. So there are a number of grassroots groups that are, you know, holding rallies and marches and really engaging folks to push back sort of from all directions. The lawsuit, we can work within the federal courts to try to have the law struck down as unconstitutional, but the pressure from the ground up against the legislature is really just as important.
Is money the only thing that talks? And I'll, you know, I'll take that influence, but I wish it were more. I have the sense that the fear of the loss of major corporations and sports leagues, I know that was a factor in Georgia. I am assuming that that may be part of the pressure in North Carolina. But does money talk? Does money have the trumping influence here?
I definitely think that the message from the business community really helps, for sure, because, you know, that's a major source of revenue in North Carolina. And so when the major businesses stand up and say, this law is discriminatory, and, you know, we don't want this in a state where we work and where we have employees, of course, that's going to have major influence. I think another message that has been helpful in some of these more conservative states is that what North Carolina did is it took away local control from Charlotte. As opposed to the state legislature, Charlotte had days of hearings on the local non-discrimination ordinance it passed, had hours of testimony on both sides. It, in fact, was a measure that had been considered a year previously, tabled, renewed this year, and then went through an enormous amount of process and public debate before the Charlotte City Council voted to adopt it. And I think by passing, and again, under 12 hours, a statewide law that prohibits localities like Charlotte from choosing what's best for their city, the legislature is actually doing something that is not at all what conservatives often say that they want, which is more local control.
Right. Elizabeth, what's the winning strategy in cases like this? The law's supporters play on emotion and fear. A purely constitutional argument doesn't seem to be enough under these circumstances.
You know, I think that's right. And I think what has to happen in North Carolina and around the country is that these laws do prey on people's fears. Folks, when they hear about laws like this and the way that the law is described to them is so disconnected from what the law actually does. And, you know, many people, they don't know that they know transgender folks and they don't really know who transgender people are. And so they're very subject to the kind of fear-based messaging that portrays all transgender people as predators, just completely wrong. And this law, I think, even worse. The folks who supported this law in the legislature, they were pushing the law out protecting people from discrimination. Mm-hmm. The way that they pushed this law out, their campaign was, we're adding in non-discrimination protections to our state law. When, of course, what they were doing is locking in discrimination. Mm-hmm. So I think there really needs to be more education about what this kind of law really does. Folks are going to have to learn more about who transgender people are, and that in that way will not be as subject to this fear-based messaging.
Elizabeth Gill is a senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Northern California and the National ACLU's Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and HIV Project. The ACLU, together with other organizations, has filed suit against North Carolina's odious new anti-LGBT law. Institutionalizing discrimination, particularly under the guise of religious freedom, is a major concern in states across the nation. The ACLU has an invaluable state-by-state resource available online, and we'll link to it once again from stateofbelief.com. Elizabeth, I want to thank you for the work that you're doing. I appreciate you being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Immigration has been a hot-button topic this election cycle, complicated by fear of terrorism and anxiety about inflows of refugees. The Public Religion Research Institute has just released a new report titled How Americans View Immigrants and What They Want from Immigration Reform. And I am very pleased that it brings PRRI's founding president, Dr. Robert P. Jones, back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, it's great to have you again.
Hi, Wilton. I'm glad to be back.
This data is based on the enormous PRRI American Values Atlas. Remind our listeners, if you will, of the sample size we're talking about and what you were looking to find out with this new report.
This is a fairly unusual project. I mean, you know, your typical public opinion polls you might see in the new, you know, cover the news is about 1,000 Americans, and this recent report is based on a data set that's roughly 40 times larger than that. So we interviewed 42,000 Americans between May 2015 and January 2016 to really ask their beliefs and attitudes about how do they perceive immigrants and what do they think we ought to do about the roughly 11 million immigrants currently living in the country illegally.
So what are the most notable findings in this survey?
Well, I think the most notable thing is that this survey is a reminder that the most heated rhetoric that we've heard around, particularly around the Republican primary campaign, has really been around, you know, building a wall, prohibiting, you know, Muslims from entering the country. It's very kind of anti-immigrant sentiment that we've heard from the Republican side of politics. And it's a good reminder that that really is not where the dial is set for most Americans. So when we ask Americans, for example, like how they perceive immigrants, are they a threat to the country, or do the growing number of newcomers strengthen American society, mm-hmm. we find about half of Americans say that immigrants strengthen the country, and about a little more than a third say they represent a threat to the country.
I'm interested in how demographics, particularly religious affiliation, plays into all of this. Are there groups that stand out in terms of the people you surveyed as well as in terms of the way different groups of immigrants are perceived based on their faith traditions?
What we find is that there is a divide in the religious community, and not surprisingly, we find religious groups that are themselves made up of groups of, you know, recent immigrants like Hindus and Muslims, Latino Protestants, Latino Catholics, tend to have more positive views of immigrants. In fact, the majorities of them say that newcomers to society strengthen America. On the other hand, we tend to see that sort of white Christian groups tend to be more negative. So fewer than half of Mormons, fewer than half even of white mainline Protestants, white Catholics say immigrants strengthen the country. But having said all that, there's really one group that stands out more than any other, and that is white evangelical Protestants as the only religious community where a majority believe that immigrants threaten traditional American customs and values, and only about a third say that newcomers benefit the society. But they really do stick out as a kind of group with a different view than every other religious group in the country.
That's really strange, because that is the group of Christians in the country that you think would be most literalistic in understanding Scripture and conservative in how to follow Jesus. And the Bible is full of material about welcoming the stranger and offering hospitality in the name of faith. Would you reflect on that just for a second?
So one thing that we found in public opinion polling, we actually have asked in the past about this theme of welcoming the stranger. And by and large, that phrase has not a lot of power with most groups in the country. The one group that it does have some leverage over is this group, white evangelical Protestants. But I think what's working at odds with that is that they are also a heavily Republican constituency. And it's important to remember when you're talking about groups, and, you know, even if we're primarily describing them as divided by religion, these are everyday people that have political identities. They're of a certain gender. They're a certain geographic area. So they live in the South. They're still predominantly South and Midwest, white evangelicals are, which is a more conservative area of the country. They are heavily Republican, tend to vote about 8 in 10 for Republican candidates. And Republicans have been very tough on this issue. The leading Republican candidates, at least, have drawn a really hard line on immigration. And I think you see that reflected here in the numbers.
Mm-hmm. I know those people well, just as you do.
I'm sure
and
you do.
I know that they would not like this, but what we're seeing is politics trump religion. Sorry for using Trump. What did you find most surprising about what you learned?
Well, even though Americans are kind of more divided about what they think about immigrants themselves, particularly newer immigrants, there's a partisan divide there. As we just talked about, there's a religion divide with white evangelicals being more negative about immigrants. There is a virtual consensus on policy. And that's really surprising. It's surprising given the divisions on perceptions of immigrants. It's also, I think, surprising just given the political polarization in the country in general. But 62% of Americans say, when it comes to policy, what should we do with the approximately 11 million immigrants who are living in the country illegally? More than 6 in 10 say that they should be allowed a way to become citizens provided they meet certain requirements. Another 15% say they should be allowed to stay but be permanent legal residents and not citizens. And only 1 in 5 say that illegal immigrants should be identified and deported. There is bipartisan agreement on this. Even a slim majority of Republicans favor a path to citizenship for immigrants living in the country illegally. Every religious group, including white evangelical Protestants who have more reservations about the impact of immigrants, support this policy. It's just quite remarkable, and yet it's a policy that has been political football and has really stalled out in Congress and just can't seem to get across the finish line.
What results did you find alarming?
One of the great things about this survey, because we had 42,000 interviews, it allowed us to actually get a statistically significant portrait of every single state in the country. What we basically see is the states that have a longer experience dealing with immigrants, so that is New York, Massachusetts, California, the places that have been historic reception points for immigrants for more than 100 years now, those states all tend to have more positive views of immigrants than states that actually have less experience dealing with immigrants and even lower levels of immigrants in the present. So it's this kind of interesting pattern of states in the Midwest, the Deep South, and then this upward swing of states through Appalachia that have the most negative views of immigrants and the most worried about this. But they're also the states that have actually had to deal with this problem less. And I think there may be a lesson to be learned there that, like, once states have actually dealt with these issues, they've actually had a pretty positive experience. And it really is the states for whom this is a new issue that I think the fears are the greatest.
You know, I'm going to ask you right now to give your website information to listeners because they may want to go see that for themselves.
Yeah, so you can see it two places. If you want to see our analysis, you can just go to our homepage. It's publicreligion.org. And we also have an interactive map where your listeners can actually play around with the data. You can click on different states, see what the different attitudes are. And that address is ava.publicreligion.org. That AVA is for American Values Atlas.
Now, I want to change the subject for just a minute. You, Robbie, were on CNN recently talking about evangelical voters and the appeal of Donald Trump. Are there insights that you'd be willing to share with our listeners, many of whom are watching this election cycle and honestly just shaking their heads?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, I, like many other people who, you know, are trying to kind of understand the lay of the land, are just like, you know, the people you're describing, have all been scratching our heads, shaking our heads, trying to figure out what's going on here. You know, there's been a lot of theories spun out, but I think my best take on it is I wrote a piece in The Atlantic a few weeks ago kind of trying to describe this, and what I concluded was that the kind of so-called values voters that were so talked about around 2004, around George W. Bush's reelection and afterward, I would say that one of the things that Trump has revealed to us is that values voters have really become what I'm calling nostalgia voters, and that this goes a long way toward explaining how white evangelical Protestants, for example, can vote for a candidate who's been divorced twice, who owns casinos, who curses during campaign speeches, and is prone to, you know, clearly demonstrates that he's unfamiliar with church culture by doing things like putting cash into the communion plate, mistakenly thinking it's the offering plate, you know, talking about 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. I mean, I could go on and on. Clearly not, you know, the typical conservative Christian or Christian right candidate. And yet, when we look at Super Tuesday, which are all the southern states, pretty much, he pretty much swept, you know, ran the table there. And one question that I think casts some light on this, we asked a question about just changes in American culture. And the question says, since the 1950s, has American culture and way of life mostly changed for the better or changed for the worse? And one of the things that we noticed about white evangelical Protestant voters is that, you know, while all Americans are kind of divided on this question, 72% of white evangelical Protestants say that American culture has changed for the worse since the 1950s. And to me, that was kind of a clue. If we put that together with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, and especially with the emphasis on that last word, I think one of the things going on is that white evangelicals are really feeling their own numbers declining, their cultural influence declining, and Trump is really, I think, promising in many ways to turn the tide of the war, kind of culture war they feel like they're losing, and in many ways turn back the clock.
So how much of an impact do you think the issue of immigration is going to have on the 2016 elections?
Well, it's clearly, if we look at conservative Republicans, right, which are, you know, the most likely people to actually participate in primaries, I think that you can understand they are fairly anti-immigrant. They have big fears about immigration, about immigrants. And you can understand why the candidates are appealing the way they are. I think the real challenge is going to be that, you know, every candidate has to turn from a primary to the general election, if they become the nominee. And the distance between where conservative Republican primary voters are and where the general public is enormous. It's often talked about as a pivot, that candidates have to kind of pivot for a more, you know, liberal or conservative position to the middle as they go to the general election. I don't even think that metaphor of a pivot works. I mean, we're talking about a marathon here that if Donald Trump is the nominee, he's going to have to run to get anywhere near where mainstream Americans are on the issue of immigration. And I think the other thing I would point to is that even a majority of younger Republicans are in a very different place as well. And in close elections, you can't afford to lose any of your base, and particularly the next generation. And I think that's the real risk for the Republican Party right now, is that their front runners are staking out a position that's very different from even their own younger voters, and that's going to prove to be a real problem.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is the founding president of the Public Religion Research Institute, which offers invaluable data and insights into the way our fellow Americans view key issues and each other. The new study, How Americans View Immigrants and What They Want from Immigration Reform, as well as the invaluable American Values Atlas, and lots of other research, is available online at publicreligion.org. Just keep up the good work and keep coming back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks, Wilton, for those kind words. I'm always glad to be here. Thanks.
Whether it was Pew Research, Public Religion Research Institute, or other respected studies of our religious landscape, recent years have seen a remarkable growth in the number of Americans who identify themselves as religiously unaffiliated. Now, a comprehensive view of the total landscape is available for the first time in a new book titled The Non-Religious: Understanding Secular People and Societies. And joining me now is one of its co-authors, Phil Zuckerman, who is professor of sociology and secular studies at Pitzer College. Phil, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
What made you feel there was a need for a kind of comprehensive book that you've written and on this particular subject?
Well, you know, the goal of social science is to understand the human condition. So whether you're a psychologist, an economist, a sociologist, anthropologist, you're fascinated by people and the human experience and culture and society. And so we want to understand that as comprehensively and thoroughly as possible. And, you know, for about 100, 150 years, the social sciences have done an excellent job studying every facet of religious life, every kind of religion, every denomination, every sect, and that's a good thing. Religion's a really important aspect of the human landscape, so you want to understand humans, you've got to understand religion, no doubt. But what we've seen is a growing chunk of humanity claiming to be non-religious, and that can mean different things to different people, but they're not going to church or synagogue or mosque, they're not identifying with a religion, some of them don't believe in God or anything supernatural, and their numbers are growing so significant that at this point, to understand humanity, we've got to also understand who are these non-religious people. Where do they live? Why are they non-religious? How do they live their lives? All the questions we might ask of the religious. As the field of secular studies grows now, we wanted to put together all the studies we could find. So I'm a sociologist, my colleague Luke is a psychologist, and my colleague Frank is an anthropologist. So we sort of felt like between those three disciplines, you know, I knew the sociological literature, Luke knew the psychological literature, Frank is really up on the anthropology, so we just thought, let's bring it all together in one volume. So somebody who was just like, who, you know, wanted to know, what do we know about non-religious people and societies, they could have a one-stop shop here and just go right to this book, and we lay it all out. It's all the studies to date relating to every aspect we could find on secular life.
You all have been doing this for at least 15 to 20 years. My sense is that public attention to the subject has surged in the past 10 years. How do you approach that?
I think the sheer numbers became so newsworthy. So, for example, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, fewer than 5% of Americans said they had no religion. In 1990, it was only 8% of Americans saying they had no religion. And I remember in, like, I think it was 2001, it jumped to 14%, according to Pew. And that was headline news. I'll never forget it. It was on CNN. It was on USA Today. Everybody, 14% of Americans. And the number just keeps ticking up. And then, you know, in 2010, it was up to 16 or 18%. Now we're at 25, roughly, percent. And among the millennials, it's over 30-35% claiming no religion. And we've just never seen anything like that. So I think on one hand, the sheer numbers, I mean, Time Magazine just a few years ago, they had a cover story on, you know, the 10 trends changing American society. And I think number four or something was the rise of the non-religious. So, so I think there's just been a demographic shift. I mean, if you think about, some people say it's around 24%, some people say it's as high as 28%. So let's just say 25% of Americans saying they have no religion. You know, there's only 2% of Americans that identify as Jews. I mean, so to have 25% of the country saying they have no religion is pretty significant. So I think there's just the news has covered it. But I also think there's more to it. I think for good or ill, you know, people were really upset after 9/11. And that's exactly when Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith, becomes an international bestseller. Mm-hmm. People were freaked out by 9/11 for good reason. They were angry after 9/11 for good reason. They were scared after 9/11 for good reason. And people, I think, were looking for something to hold on to as some kind of answer. Why is this happening? What's going on? And when Sam Harris comes out and says, well, it's religion's fault, you know, Islam's evil and these fundamentalists are terrorists, I think, you know, that resonated for people. And of course, Sam took on all of religion. He didn't just pick on fundamentalists per se. He said, oh, well, all religion's irrational, which I think is an overstatement personally. But still, it resonated for a lot of Americans and around the world. And then you just had this cascade of bestsellers, the Sam Harris book, the Christopher Hitchens, the Richard Dawkins, a lot of sort of public voices out there. So why this has taken hold, I think, is, you know, on one hand, it's just reflecting the demographics. On another hand, there's been a real public outburst of what they call the new atheism.
I wonder also if some of this is not about change. Some of it is about freedom to be honest. Because I have a sense that there have been a lot of people long before we started talking about the nuns that perhaps held those non-religious convictions but were scared to say so because of social pressure.
That's the best thing I've heard all day. I totally agree. I am so glad that you have said that. I absolutely agree. You know, it's so funny. People often say to me when I talk about the research, and I'll talk about the percentage of people saying, you know, that they're non-religious, I'll say, oh, you know, it's such and such a percent say they have no religion. And every time someone in the audience will stand, raise their hand and say, well, that doesn't mean they don't believe in God. You know, you're implying that they're all atheists. Maybe they just don't want to identify with the religion, but that doesn't mean they don't have an inner spiritual life. And I always say, you're absolutely correct, but it works the other way as well. So many of the people who tick the box Lutheran or Episcopalian or Catholic or Jewish or whatever, Methodist, or even go to church, that also doesn't mean they necessarily believe in their hearts in this stuff. They could be doing it to make family happy. They could be doing it to just keep the spouse happy. They could be doing it just because out of tradition, out of inertia for the community. So I think you're spot on. I think there have always been men and women who did not believe or who doubted or who were skeptical but didn't feel comfortable or safe, either safe in their families or safe in the larger culture. I mean, let's face it, there are many societies throughout history where if you came out as a non-believer, you got killed or right. You know, you got tortured, you got your tongue cut out. Even today in much of the Islamic world, I think there's 13 countries in the Islamic world today that it's a death penalty if you reject religion or reject Islam. So mm-hmm. I think you're correct. And that's part of our secular studies goal, actually, is to unearth evidence of people who were non-believers or were non-religious in the past and couldn't say so or could only say so in letters that were published after they died or whatnot. I just read about a Catholic priest in the 1700s who wrote an entire book saying this is all BS, I don't believe any of it, but of course he just buried it, and then after he died it was discovered. And he said, I can't say these things while I'm alive, I'll be killed and tortured, but I want you to know that I don't believe any of this stuff, and you shouldn't either or whatnot. And that's from the 1700s. So I agree with you that now it's easier to come out as non-believing. I think the internet's been a part of that, allowing people to find community online. But you also see it in entertainment, you know, in the Jon Stewart's, the Stephen Colbert's, the House, the Family Guy, the South Park. I think there's a cultural shift where it's okay to be secular and it's okay to critique religion. And I'm not necessarily saying that's a good or bad thing, but it clearly is a thing.
Is there a predictive function sociology offers in terms of the impact on our society and culture of these changes?
There is a bit of a danger. We know that religion is one of the greatest sources of binding people together and creating what Robert Putnam called social capital, meaning, you know, you have positive connections with lots of different people that you can draw on for social support, for help in times of need, And where there's high social capital, life is better. There's less crime, people live longer, people are happier. So having, you know, good, close connections with different people in your community that is positive is a good thing. And religion has often been part of that glue. Some theorists argue that religion began that way, that it was something that bound people together. In fact, one of the original roots of the word religion is to bind together. So religion, by providing rituals, community, sacralizing certain aspects of the year, a coming-of-age traditions and rituals, there's so many things that religion does, binding people together around common beliefs that have positive social outcomes and benefits, no doubt about it. And as we become more secular, we are becoming more individualistic. There's no question that individualism and secularism are co-related. So we don't know what the future is going to hold. If people are dropping out of religious groups, how are they going to replace those communal bonds? And maybe they won't. And that may have a deleterious effect on social cohesion and on social capital. On the other hand, we do know that increased secularism in other societies, for example, Europe, has not yet, at least, resulted in social chaos. The most secular societies today are still doing well. They have low crime rates. They have low poverty rates. They have high participation of women in government and politics and business. So if we just look at the world today, over the last 75 years, let's say, the societies that have secularized the most are doing okay. In fact, in many cases, they're doing really well. In fact, you could even compare the 10 most secular, non-church-attending, non-God-believing states in the United States with the 10 most religious, and the correlation still holds that the 10 most religious actually have higher murder rates, higher poverty rates, domestic abuse rates, child abuse rates. So religion does a lot of good, there's no question about it, but it's not necessarily the guarantor of all things beneficial that some people think it is. And in many ways, being secular is highly correlated with a lot of positive things. For example, secular people tend to score lower on scores of racism, just a tendency. It's not absolute, it's an average. They tend to score lower on psychological tests that look at sexism. They tend to be less likely to believe in corporal punishment for their kids. They tend to be highly educated. So, I mean, there's a lot of good correlates with secularity, and there's some questionable correlates as well. So it's complex like everything in the world,
sure,
in the social world.
Well, look, you all take a sweeping view of this. It's not just domestic, it's international. How does understanding the non-religious in other countries and cultures help us understand this community in the United States?
Well, we're increasingly linked to other societies. It's just more and more unavoidable. What happens in Syria affects San Francisco, you know? It's just the way of the world. And so when we're looking at the world today, for example, we need to understand secularism in Turkey, because the fight between the secular elite in Turkey and the Muslim fundamentalists in Turkey is going to affect Europe and the Middle East and us. If Canada is becoming increasingly secular, that's going to affect our relationships with them. If we understand terrorists in France attacking France, and in France, if secularity, what they call laïcité, is so important, that we need to understand that as well. So in our book, we wanted to be a little less provincial and say, hey, we're part of a global world here. We need to understand the secular landscape, not just in the United States, but in other societies as well, because we can learn from some of the patterns there. Obviously, every country is unique and different. The United States is not like Sweden in many ways. They're very different. But we are very similar to other large industrial societies like the United Kingdom. And so to see how secularism plays out there can at least help us understand how it's playing out here in terms of similarities and differences.
Phil Zuckerman is co-author of The Non-Religious, Understanding Secular People and Societies. Phil Zuckerman is professor of sociology and secular studies at Pitzer College. His co-authors are Luke Galen, professor of psychology at Grand Valley State University, and Frank Pasquale, a cultural anthropologist. Phil, thank you so much for being with us here on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk, and I thank you for your interest.
Now, before we go, I'd like you to listen to the following comments from Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline.
I don't know if you've heard, but there is a bill pending before the South Carolina State Legislature that would require houses of worship and faith-based organizations that sponsored refugees coming to the United States, fleeing oppression across the sea, to be held liable for those individuals during the life of their stay in the United States. The churches and other houses of worship would be required to register these individuals with the State Department and then be held responsible for the results of any crime that they committed during the length of their stay in this country, and I presume before any naturalization that would take place. I hope you hear in that the further weaponization of the First Amendment that has been the attempt of many groups on the right over the course of the past number of years. It's also a violation of the Establishment Clause by making houses of worship extensions of the state, agents of the police and the FBI, as it were, and an interference with the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment that enables faith-based institutions to pursue their mission within the law without the infringement of government. At the same time, we have some of the same folks trying to restrict the ability of faith-based institutions to welcome other groups into their midst. Groups, for example, like people who are LGBT, and restrict the ability of those groups to access the civil rights that are theirs by virtue of being citizens and residents of the United States. It is Interfaith Alliance, as you know, that is active in protecting faith and freedom, that stands against the agenda of antipathy, that stands against the defense of discrimination that has become the stock and trade of the religious right. That's why our work in protecting faith and freedom is so important, and that's why your support of that work is so appreciated, and why I'm asking you to continue and increase what you've done with us and for us already. After all, it is Interfaith Alliance that is defending the true meaning of religious liberty in this country in the hopes of being a partner in creating an America that is an expression of the beloved community. Thanks for listening.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown up around State of Belief Radio, we'd like a whole lot. It's active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.